This episode of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. So if you enjoy the show and want it to continue, please support us on Patreon over at patreon.com/geeks or via PayPal over at geeksguideshow.com/crowdfunding. And I want to give a special thank you to Dave Baxter, who just signed up this week to support us on Patreon. So big thanks again to everyone who's contributed. We really appreciate it. All right, so now let's get to our show. Hello, and welcome to episode 566 of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. I'm David Barr Kirtley, author of the book Save Me, Please, and Other Stories. Publishers Weekly says, visceral settings and robust characters will have readers marveling at how much Kirtley is able to fit into a limited page count. For SFF fans with no time to sink into a doorstopper, these concentrated doses of genre goodness will hit the spot. And Kirkus Reviews writes, Kirtley employs sharp, concise prose that complements his puckish sense of humor. The author's passionate voice breathes life into this wonderful array of tales. So again, the book is called Save Me, Please, and Other Stories, and it's available now on Amazon.com. And today on the show, we'll be discussing Season 1 of the Amazon Prime series Fallout, based on the popular series of post-apocalyptic video games. And this will include spoilers for everything in Season 1, so just be aware of that. And I'm joined by three guests. So first up, we've got our producer, John Joseph Adams. He's the editor of Lightspeed Magazine, and the series editor of the Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy, and he's also edited more than 40 other anthologies, including Wastelands, Stories of the Apocalypse, The Apocalypse Triptych, and Press Start to Play. His most recent projects are the Amazon Original Stories Collection, The Far Reaches, and Out There Screaming, an anthology of new black horror, which he edited with Jordan Peele. So, John, welcome back.
Always good to be here.
The next up, we've got Teresa DeLucci, making her 18th appearance on the show. She reviews books, TV, and video games for Den of Geek and Tor.com, and her short fiction appears in Strange Horizons, Weird Horror, and Lightspeed. Her short story Cavity will appear in the upcoming Ellen Datlow anthology Fears, Tales of Psychological Horror. So, Teresa, welcome to the show.
Howdy, thanks for having me back.
And also joining us today is Zach Chapman, making his 15th appearance on the show. His short fiction appears in Nature, Tales to Terrify, and Writers of the Future. And he's also the creator of the comic book series House of Blood and The Spellslinger, and co-creator of the comic book series A Haunting on Mars. His latest comic book series, Kaiju Blues, is currently in pre-launch on Kickstarter. So, Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so let's start off with Zach and have you tell us about your history playing Fallout.
So I don't have a super significant history playing Fallout, but I was a big Bethesda fan. I was a big Elder Scrolls fan when I was in high school. And then when I was a freshman in college, Fallout 3 came out. And that was the game after, I believe it was the game after Oblivion, which I was just like, I would stay up all night in high school playing Oblivion. Like with the, you know, acting like I was asleep, but playing Oblivion. And this was kind of their, they purchased or licensed, the Fallout series, and they did Fallout 3 as a pretty much as a first person shooter, not a CRPG. And so that's my experience of the game is not like a computer RPG, but, kind of like a tactical first-person shooter, if that makes sense. They had this whole VAT system, which like slows down, pauses time, and you can shoot different body parts. So it is like a first-person shooter, but it is also a little bit tactical, and it is an RPG. And man, I played at the time, and this has been over a decade, but you know, 100 hours more. I played all the DLCs, like got the Zeta Alien DLC, got the Fall of Anchorage DLC, played
all that.
Those are
both so good. Oh my God.
Yeah, I was like totally obsessed. In fact, I think this kind of goes full circle into like my obsession with Geek's Guide because I was obsessed with Fallout, and then I got obsessed with, you know, post-apocalyptic stuff. Then I picked up John Joseph Adams' Wastelands, the first book, and read all of that and loved that. And then I was like, you know, at that point, you know, years had passed, a couple of years had passed. I was doing my first, one of my first major jobs, and, you know, just kind of doing data entry and listening to podcasts. Was like, oh, that was kind of new. And so I was like, what is John Joseph Adams doing on podcasts? And then that, so that's how I became a fan. Kind of, it's because, wow, a little bit because of my obsession with Fallout 3. I did play New Vegas, but, and I know New Vegas is kind of supposed to be a better game, but I played it on launch and it was really broken on launch. I remember it crashing like three or four times, like within the first like 6 or 7 hours that I was playing. So I didn't have the greatest experience. I know it got patched and it's probably been fixed since then. And I played a little bit of 4 and a little bit of 76. And now having watched,
I think
the show,
everybody's played a little bit of 76.
I'm definitely going to go back and play 4. Not so
you
much.
Definitely 76. Go back and play New Vegas because New Vegas is fucking dope.
Cool. Yeah, I will.
It works like, now.
Yeah.
Especially after, man, this series is like one huge advertisement for the game.
Oh, yeah.
That's really cool, though, that we owe. It sounds like we owe a lot to Fallout 3 for bringing Zach into all our lives.
We actually owe Fallout, the series, even more because it kind of, you know, led. It fostered my interest in post-apocalyptic fiction, which led me to find books and stories about it. And that's what sort of led me in a lot of ways. Fallout is why I'm an editor because, or at least why I have an anthology career because, you know, my first anthology was Wastelands and, you know, I don't know that Wastelands would have happened if not for Fallout. You know, it's hugely influential to me.
Well, so how about Teresa? Do you owe your whole career to Fallout in any way?
No, I'd say I'm more of a Red Dead Redemption kind of person. But, you know, I played Fallout 3 a little bit, like when it first came out, and admit that I was totally overwhelmed by the heads up display and the map and could not figure out where the hell I was going. So I got very frustrated until I played Skyrim and then kind of understood, oh, that's how this works. So, you know, because I came definitely from like the Rockstar kind of game with the in-game map and everything. But I remember being really drawn to the vaults. Liam Neeson did voice acting in the third game. And
oh,
that's the kind of, yeah, he's the one who kind of like welcomes you to the vault and your character.
He's the
creation.
Father. He's the father in the vault overseer.
Gotcha.
Yes. You know, so, you know, really like that. And then I've been meaning to play New Vegas, but now that the show has come out and I hear they're doing remasters of the games.
Oh,
yay.
Yeah. Now I want to go back and play New Vegas properly, you know, with better understanding.
And then John, tell us about your extensive history.
Yeah. I was going to say I did a sort of brief, I alluded briefly to my history, but it's like, okay, everybody else is establishing their bona fides. I got to get in here. And cause I'm an OG Fallout player. Like, okay. So even before Fallout, there was a game called Wasteland, which is actually where I got the name for Wastelands from. So Wasteland was made by Brian Fargo. Fallout was also created by Brian Fargo. So really it's Brian Fargo's fault that I'm here. So Wasteland was a classic RPG, you know, classic computer RPG, and it wasn't like Fallout, but it was just straight up post-apocalyptic game, and it was pretty dope. But then they wanted to make a sequel to it. They couldn't get the rights to it, so Brian Fargo ended up making Fallout. And so I played Fallout 1, Fallout 2, and then like years and years went by. And then when Fallout 3 came out, I played that, and I played New Vegas, and I played Fallout 4. I did not play Fallout 76 just because, you know, I wasn't really into the like MMO part of it or whatever. Like it didn't sound like it had like NPCs and was like there was quests and stuff as much. now I guess it, there is that. So I was thinking about going back and playing some of it, especially because a bunch of people on the Discord server I'm on are talking about playing it. And like, so at least it's like, hey, there's people I know that are playing it. You know, as we talked about on the Baldur's Gate 3 panel, I do get a little bit obsessed with video games. And that was certainly true with all of the Fallout games. I was very resistant to the first person shooter aspect of it when I first saw that Fallout 3 was coming out, because Fallout 1 and 2 are, like isometric view. They seem like perfectly good that way. And like, I had even gone back and played, I think Fallout 1, I replayed Fallout 1, like after I played Fallout 3. And so it was like years and years later where it's like, okay, this is clearly like not up to snuff in terms of graphics and stuff, but it's like, it still worked well enough. It was just all the lore and the great post-apocalyptic elements to it that, just really resonated with me. And, like I said, it set me off on this career.
Yeah. And I'll just say, I mean, I played Wastelands as a kid. I mean, I didn't, one of my friends had it, so I didn't play it that much, but it was definitely a formative influence on me. And then I had played the Fallout demo when it came out. So it was like the vault and creating a character and going to the first, it was the first town in the game basically. Mm-hmm. And then the game ended. So, and then I never played any of the other ones. I've watched reviews of them and stuff. So I kind of like had a vague idea of what had happened with the series since then, but I had like a fair amount of residual nostalgia for the series just because it was such an early kind of thing that I encountered. So I was excited about the Fallout show. And then I saw this, the trailer, and the trailer looked really goofy. And I was like, I don't know if this is gonna, serious misgivings.
Glad you said that, because I felt like, am I the only person that just had no interest in watching this show based off of the trailer? Like, it didn't look very good to me.
I agree. And I felt like I had heard there were like production drama going on, or it felt like it got delayed a bit, which didn't give me a lot of confidence either.
Yeah, I didn't question it. I mean, because like it looked so amazing. Visually, like it looked perfect. At least the trailer I saw. I don't know if y'all saw a trailer that was before a trailer I saw or something. I think I saw the first one, but just the look of everything looked so good. I was like, okay, I'm in. I'm gonna definitely watch it right away.
You didn't think it looked like it was just gonna be over the top goofiness?
Well, I mean, it was possible that it was, but I was willing to go with it and at least try it, just based on how good everything looked. And because it was like created by Jonathan Nolan. And so I figured at least the first season would be good.
Well, so that's the thing. So I saw that I was excited because just any sort of video game thing that gets attention for the forum and stuff, I'm excited about. And Zach and I, and Teresa, I guess, too, for some of... Well, Teresa's only talked about the good video game ones, but Zach and I have... we watched like 20 or 25 video game movie adaptations. Oof. I think all of which were below 55% on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. I think most of them well below 55% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
there's some like 8% that I actually like.
Wow.
Which one?
I am an unabashed apologist for Double Dragon.
Oh, okay.
And I also like the original Mortal Kombat. And I kind of like the original Street Fighter too.
Yeah, but just the idea, just coming from that, just the idea that now, like, I guess we were talking about a little bit on email, that you've got stuff like Arcane and The Last of Us. These are, some of the best shows on TV are these video game things.
Yeah.
It's just Last of Us is so good. Speaking of, like, post-apocalyptic shows, I mean, that's a zombie show, but still, it's post-apocalyptic for sure.
Taking
a step back and, like, seeing this evolution of the very first video game adaptations are some of the worst adaptations ever created. I mean, we watched Mario Bros, and it's like, no one apologizes for that. It's just awful. And then now it's like, we have like, pick the last three shows, like the last three video game adaptation episodes. It's all like, we will criticize these things, but it's like, these are above 9 out of 10s for me. Those three, I just really love what this golden age that we're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was excited just because it was a video game thing, and I'll watch any video game thing, as I think I've demonstrated. but then I heard all this stuff like online about, oh, like Todd Howard sucks. He's the head of Bethesda.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to suck because Todd Howard's involved. And I was like kind of disconnected from that whole drama. So I wasn't sure exactly what was going on with that. I have since read up on it quite a bit. But at the time I was like, okay, well, the trailer looks kind of goofy to me, and it seems like people were saying basically that like the real brains behind what made Fallout great were like earlier people like Brian Fargo and Tim Kaine and Chris Avellone and stuff. And that Todd Howard kind of swooped in and bought the rights and didn't really get the franchise and had kind of like ruined it and stuff. That was just sort of the buzz online. So I don't know if this is going to be good, but Teresa, were you going to add something there?
Oh yeah. No, just saying, like, I feel that's always the temperature online. I remember before The Last of Us came out, I mean, Neil Druckmann just gets so much online hate all the time from a certain very vocal faction of gamers, and they give him no grace at all. So, yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jack.
I've heard a lot of that Todd Howard hate, like from friends of mine, and someone who came on in Fallout 3, like I guess. And then didn't really like New Vegas that much mainly because of the bugs. Like I guess I have trouble understanding like what the take is. Is that the take that like he's not OG, he doesn't get the setting, or that he changed it?
Yeah. So basically, just to run through quickly the history, and I just brushed up on this yesterday. I'm not an expert, but this is sort of what I gather, is that so you had the first two games, which were made by kind of old school RPG people, and they're, you know, top down isometric games, lots of stats, you know, really hard, really good writing, really gritty. And then some of those people, and of course, because it's video games, the people are all like, the rights are always being passed around and people are leaving and forming new studios and everything. So even the first two games were made by largely different teams, but the old school fan contingent feels that those games were like gritty and hard and crunchy and good. And then some of those people were going to make a third Fallout game, which was actually pretty far into development, but it got canceled because the company went out of business. I think it was Interplay went out of business. And then Bethesda like outbid those people for the rights to the IP. And then they turned it into the, you know, first person 3D game. So that's kind of like a, you know, which sort of de-emphasizes the role-playing game aspect.
Kind of mainstreamifies it, maybe?
Yeah. Makes it more accessible, but less, you know, challenging or whatever. So that's one aspect of it. But then there's also a feeling that they made it less gritty and sort of made it like less like a believable, coherent post-apocalyptic world, and made it more into like a goofy theme park, like post-apocalyptic theme park kind of atmosphere, where you're walking around talking to all these wacky characters and it's just sort of silly and not scary. And it doesn't really make sense. You never see anybody growing crops. It's like, how does any of this stuff work? And then it's like hundreds of years after the apocalypse, but it still looks like everything's all ruined and there's skeletons everywhere and stuff. And so it just doesn't seem, it's like the post-apocalyptic stuff is just sort of like an aesthetic or a gimmick rather than, you know, taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I haven't played any of these games, so I'm just repeating, I
really want to know John's stance on this, because he was OG fan and then he's played these other games, and it's like, I guess I'm not able to like pass that judgment, but like that feels a little unfair.
Yeah. I mean, that definitely feels unfair to me. I don't remember those kind of details from the original games, but I mean, like, I certainly didn't feel any kind of dissonance between, having played those original games and then playing Fallout 3. Like, I mean, I loved Fallout 3 when I played it. It really felt like Fallout to me. It was different, obviously, because it was first person shooter, but it still had VATS, you know, and VATS is the entire combat system for the first two games. And I mean, it was turn-based entirely, but at least it lets you kind of simulate turn-based in that way. And honestly, I couldn't even play Fallout without VATS. Like I would die all the time without VATS, which is weird because like I could play Skyrim, which doesn't have it, you know, and it's like the same exact combat system.
Yeah.
One other wrinkle to this, which is that after they made Fallout 3, after Bethesda made Fallout 3, they licensed the rights to make Fallout New Vegas to some of the people, some of the old school people, like including Chris Avellone.
Yeah.
And so there's a feeling among that contingent that Fallout New Vegas was just way better than the Bethesda games. The writing was so much better. And so, like, in a way, you have to give credit to Bethesda for, you know, encouraging that sort of competition, I guess. Yeah. But then they made Fallout 4, which even more made it more apparently just more first-person shooter and even more downplayed the RPG aspects. And then they made Fallout 76, which has a terrible reputation. Mm-hmm. I guess, like people were saying, they kind of patched it a lot. Mm-hmm. So maybe it's probably better now. But on launch, it was just excoriated like like no other game. You know, well, I shouldn't say that because video game gamers are not short on vitriol, but it was really not well received.
Boy, excoriated and vitriol in like the same sentence, like well done, man.
There's just the Fallout fandom, as far as I can tell, is just incredibly fractious, and so. You know, there's
now
in
fractious? Wow, man, you're really bringing it
all out. Gosh, wait, let me talk about it first before I continue recording.
So I don't know. Does anyone have any reaction to any of that? Does that all sound right as far as everybody knows? That is like what the tenor of the online discussion has been?
I mean, that's what it's always felt like to me, like with my friends and everyone trying to shit on Todd Howard, but I mean, maybe I'm a basic bitch, but man, I loved Oblivion and I loved everything since then. That was like my entryway into Bethesda games, and that game is really a broken, like once you get past a certain level, it, because of level scaling, it's completely broken. But each game since then has like fixed their systems and they've gotten better in my opinion.
Well, that's the thing I guess I should explain too, is that these games are incredibly popular, the Bethesda games, you know, so I mean millions and millions and millions of copies sold, you know, so way more popular than, you know, by orders of magnitude than the original Fallout 1 and 2 were. So like I guess it seems like there's this sense among like the old school fans or whatever that Bethesda, it's like Michael Bay or something. It's like, you know, like really popular in a way that doesn't deserve to be popular.
So I blissfully managed to avoid all of the online discourse about it. I never even heard about the hate for Todd Howard or anything. It was only like recently that I even knew that guy's name. So it was like, hey, I don't know. I managed to do something right there.
Yeah. So those were my expectations going to the show. Does anyone have anything they want to add about any expectations they had going into the show?
I mean, I'm a huge Walton Goggins fan. I've loved every single thing I've seen him in, from like The Shield and Sons of Anarchy, Justified, Uncle Baby Billy and Righteous Gemstones. Like it was for him that it really got me curious, you know, and wanted to check out the show for sure, because he picks really good projects. I feel like I have a lot of trust in him. Mm-hmm.
And he's absolutely incredible in this. Like,
oh my God, he's my favorite part.
Yeah. I felt bad because like I never watched Justified, and I'd heard like he was fantastic in that. And I was like, I was just like blown away by him, because it was like, you know, I had seen The Shield. And so like I knew him from that, but I was like, oh my God, he's so much better. He's like so good. I mean, as good as he was in The Shield, you know, but then, apparently I missed his greatest performance before this which is supposedly Justified. So, but still.
Absolutely. You should go back and watch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
But as far as expectations, I mean, you know, I was just excited by, you know, how good it looked, like just visually. You know, I didn't clock the overly goofy vibe of it, I guess, or if I did, I put it out of my mind and was just trusting in Jonathan Nolan. I just kind of, it was kind of a wish and a prayer kind of situation where it was like, oh, it better be good, you know?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll explain. So if you don't know the video game, so sort of the hook of the games basically is that it's a post-apocalyptic story told through the lens of kind of like 50s techno-optimist, you know, public service announcement kind of thing. So there's this really interesting contrast between the sort of corny, cheery 50s music and 50s, you know, optimism and technology and everything. There's a contrast between that and the super dark nuclear war has destroyed the world. So there's a kind of interesting balance to that. And so I think one reason the trailer, you know, turned me off a little bit is that it leans really heavily into the 50s stuff. And so in the actual show, you have a good balance, but in the trailer, you don't have that balance.
I think maybe that balance is just potentially like impossible to strike in like a 30 second clip or maybe like a minute and a half, because like what you're saying is like Fallout is so many of these like deeply cynical satirical ideas with like that are very funny and weird, contrasting with like a very serious, somber you know, post-apocalyptic nuclear war, and conveying all of that in 30 seconds or a minute and a half, it's like, that might be impossible. So maybe that's why I was like, this looks stupid and I'm not interested in it.
I feel like I need to go watch the trailer again and just see, because like, I just don't remember any of that. Like,
or maybe I like didn't even, I don't know, maybe just something's like wrong with me and I didn't even, maybe I watched like some of the trailer and I just was like, I don't know what.
No, but all of us.
Something about the marketing. I don't know. It just turned me off.
But all three of us, you know, had the same reaction to the trailer, it seems like. So
maybe we're so scarred by previous video game adaptations that you're just so cynical about it that you, you know, really keyed on every slight misstep that it made.
I think we have been overexposed to video game adaptations, and that might be some past trauma.
Yeah, and I also think for me, like Amazon Prime, I know they've had some good shows, I guess, but I can't really think of too many. For me, like the ones that stand out to me that I watched were not that great. Like I'm thinking of like stuff like Picnic at Hanging Rock, and you know, it's like they're always trying to be the go-to for prestige TV now.
And I really love The Boys and Invincible, which are both also adaptations of geek culture things. And I think they do very well, especially Invincible. It's like it almost improves on the source material. But and I think that those are both Amazon.
I haven't watched either of those. I mean, they're superhero things, so that's kind of a different you know.
Yeah, I haven't watched The Boys yet, although I've, you know, heard it takes that like satirical kind of tone as well. But yeah, I mean, I don't go to Prime as, you know, my go-to for new TV shows. It'll be like Netflix or Hulu, Max, stuff like that.
Or Apple TV has been killing it.
Yeah, Apple TV has been killing it lately. Like that's all the other shows that I'm watching right now.
So. Which is actually funny, speaking of Apple TV, because Apple TV has Silo on it, which has so many similarities with Fallout. It's kind of hilarious that they're both airing at the same time, and like they're only separated by like a couple of months from when they aired to when this one debuted. You know, it's both, you know, both have people living in an underground, like sort of vault/silo, and, you know, are frightened about what the outside is like, and then they have to venture out into the outside for the first time and all that kind of stuff. And so it's like, yeah, it's just a lot of similarities. I mean, I think Howie was clearly influenced by Fallout when he wrote Silo.
Yeah. Well, and actually there's a talk by Tim Kaine where he talks about some of the things that he was influenced or that team was influenced by. So like Canticle for Leibowitz, you know, The Road Warrior, stuff like that. So, you know, these ideas of the bomb shelter and the post-apocalyptic world are, you know, sort of the common heritage of science fiction.
And if anybody wants to go read some shit after this panel, it's like Dave just said it, Canticle for Leibowitz. If you want to read it like a novel, like go read that. It's amazing. It's like it's like probably the best post-apocalyptic novel I've ever read.
I know a really good anthology.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's some good anthologies out there. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, apparently the Brotherhood of Steel, their kind of whole ethos was sort of just directly lifted from Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yeah.
But so just to, if you haven't actually watched the show, just to set up the basic setting, it's like, yeah, we're hundreds of years after, you know, nuclear war has destroyed the world. And so in, on the surface, there is, you know, mutated monsters and survivors living in kind of, you know, ruined, you know, they're sort of trying to rebuild civilization. And there's people called ghouls who are somehow, they're sort of, they're like zombies, basically, and they regenerate really fast. And then you also have these vaults underground where this company called Vault Tech had built all these vaults, and they have, you know, people living underground intending to one day rebuild civilization. And so we've got three main characters, and one of them is the ghoul, is one of the ghouls that Teresa mentioned, and he's Cooper Howard. He used to be a TV, like a John Wayne style TV star. And now he's wandering the wastelands as a, you know, sort of violent badass cowboy kind of guy. You've got Lucy, who was raised in the vault and has never left the vault before. And she's very innocent and naive and good natured. And then you've got Maximus, who is part of this Brotherhood of Steel, which is sort of these sort of the remnants of the U.S. military. And so they have the best weapons and equipment. They have this cool power armor stuff. And they've sort of turned into this kind of almost like monk-like religious order where they are determined to preserve civilization.
Or technology anyway.
Yeah. Preserve preserve the old world kind of technology, I guess. So how about Teresa? What did you think of those characters? I mean, well, I guess we know you liked Cooper Howard.
Yes, but absolutely. Always love a good cowboy, especially when it's Walton Goggins, that's established. You know, I also really enjoyed Lucy more than I was expecting to. You know, I'm familiar with the actress who plays her, Ella Purnell from Yellow Jackets, which is a fantastic show. But she wasn't in it. That's super long. So it's nice to see her again. And I thought she brought a lot of humor to her performance, this wide-eyed innocence that wasn't cloying, you know, and watching her change, I thought was really great. And watching her interact with the ghoul and then with Maximus, you know, especially the two of them have a lot of story together. So I was most interested in those two stories, Brotherhood of Steel, maybe a little less so.
Mm.
But that's just me. I'm never one for power armor.
Ugh.
You're not into power armor.
Really?
Dang, I know another good anthology.
Why did you put her on the show? Doesn't like power armor.
The tech stuff, you know, give me good old-fashioned guns.
Well, and the power armor in this show was so fucking cool.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's cool. I think, for me, it's more Maximus. Like, get it out right there. It was Maximus himself who was not as
okay,
compelling.
But Teresa, don't interrupt me when I'm talking about power armor. No, it was so cool. And it was all apparently all practical effects, or almost all practical.
Nice.
Like they actually built those suits, you know, like it's not CGI. And it just looks so much better than any other power armor.
For fuck's sake, they made functional Pip-Boys. Of course they built the fucking power armor. Functional Pip-Boys. Not just on their arm. They built them so that they could use them. That's crazy.
So how about Zach? What'd you think of those?
I love all three of them. I think they're I think that their stories are pretty well fleshed out. I like them all probably equally, but Lucy's is like it reflects at least my playing of specifically Fallout 3 and 4. It kind of reflects the player character and the progression, like her storyline is so like the progression of a player character who in both of those games, you come out of a vault, and then you're kind of presented with the apocalypse, and then you change over time. Like you start, getting better at the game and getting better equipment and getting better weapons. And, that's like her story. I mean, that's like a very reductionist view of her story, but like, it's cool that whoever wrote this, it feels like they played the games and they were like, we're not doing a direct adaptation of the games, but we're kind of like recreating the sense of like your player's progression as you become more of a badass and figure out the systems. And then also figure out like the random, like episodic quest natures of these open world Bethesda games, or, you know, pre-Bethesda games, where you'll be walking around and then she'll be walking around and then she just goes into a random building and it's like, well, this is super episodic, but also kind of lends to her growing as a character and, you know, to kind of be dumb, but like getting experience points. And I just, I think that that's super cool.
Well, apparently Jonathan Nolan is a big fan of Fallout. I mean, he specifically, you know, he's a fan of the games and then specifically went looking to do this because of that. And I mean, I guess I'll just say, I thought the show was like awesome. I mean, I basically have no major complaints about it. And I think it's sort of miraculous given, you know, there's like 20 producers, there's this IP that, you know, you know, as there's so much like conflict over, you know, I mean, it seems like, you know, it was like Bethesda had to work with, you know, there's like even two showrunners who are like different from Jonathan Nolan. It just seems like there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Seems like a lot of potential for this to go very, very wrong. And just like, I don't know how, but it ended up just being great.
This, like, you know what it feels like? And this might be like blasphemous to say, but it feels like Star Wars. Like, it's so deep. It's so rich. There's so much random, like, it's like a fucking universe that like you could just be in, and they captured that. Like, they actually captured the feeling of being in another setting, like something as big as Star Wars and as expansive as Star Wars, like, has been captured in this first season of a television show.
But does everyone agree that this is basically pretty close to a perfect Fallout TV show?
So let me jump in, because I didn't actually comment on that yet. But I mean, like, I did love it. I thought it was amazing. I do have like a lot of quibbles, as I would have for anything I watch, basically, especially for something that's based on something I love. But I mean, I loved Lucy. I thought she was great. I was not familiar with that actress, but I thought she did a wonderful job. She kind of reminds me of Emma Stone, like a lot in her, like a lot of her facial expressions and stuff. And she kind of looks like her a little bit, but I thought she was great. She did a really good job of portraying that naive character. And I love the power armor. I really liked Maximus in that storyline. I'm you know, not entirely sold on that actor, but I mean, I really liked all of that. And of course the ghoul. Although I will say, in episode two, I was like, ghoul, you're my favorite, but if you hurt that fucking dog. Right. And then he shot him, I think, but luckily the dog did not die, so I forgive him. And then he was good to the dog after that. So
how about Teresa, just overall, how would you rate this show as a Fallout adaptation?
Yeah, I mean, I'd give it an A, you know, having come off of The Last of Us, which is one of my most favorite game series ever, and being blown away by that, and how Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann, the game runner, mapped out that story, and how they chose to adapt and what they wanted to add and what they didn't. I really enjoyed that. But here it was like the flip side of The Last of Us, doing Apocalypse with like the satirical bite that the series had. And that's I think that's a harder tone to balance, right? And I think they did a fantastic job, because, you know, I got to say, like, my expectations were maybe not super high for this. I'm like, oh, it looks polished, but is it going to be good? And then being like really entertained and like, oh no, we have to watch the next episode right now. Like, I can't wait anymore. Yeah. I got to see what's going to happen next. Like, it was super bingeable. You know?
Yeah, I watched this in one day. And like, by the time I got to episode 7 and 8, I was starting to get a little loopy. And so my, you know, but I wanted to know what happened so much. I was pushing through, but yeah, I watched the whole thing. Nice. You know,
yeah. Like day. This, you could binge in a day. Last of Us, you would slit your wrist.
Yeah. Well, overall, I would say, like, I would say 10 out of 10 adaptation for sure. And I mean, I loved it. I loved it as well. I mean, I as soon as we finished watching it, Christy and I were like, well, what are we going to watch next? And I'm like, well, I mean, we could just rewatch this. and we didn't end up doing it, but I mean, I was like, we both seriously were like, yeah, we'd be up for it. You know, we just didn't end up doing it. But
I'm seriously like, well, I could re-download Fallout 4 because it's getting, as soon as the show launched, it got next gen support and texture updates and stuff. So it's like, I know what I'm going to be doing whenever I have free time. Like that's like now on my to-do list to go replay that.
Let me just say the only sort of misgiving I had, which was very, very minor, I mean, it's, aside from like little quibble stuff, is that this show is super gory. You know, it's Evil Dead level gory. And like,
so are the games.
But
yeah.
Well, but I just feel like, you know, there's a lot of people that I would recommend this to if it weren't so gory. But given how gory it is, I'm like, I'm not sure they're going to like it for that reason.
Right.
So I feel like it's limiting the audience a little bit. What was that, Teresa?
I feel like the tone of the gore on this, though, is still so over the top. It's humorous to me.
See, like, they basically
like, maybe
had,
I'm just sick.
They basically had to do it, like, to be, like, to be, like, an honest Fallout adaptation. Because, like, going back to even Fallout 1 and 2, there was a feat you could take called Bloody Mess, which just, like, it was very violent anyway. But if you took this Bloody Mess feat, then it's, like, it was just, like, a whole other level. And it didn't even do anything for you. It wasn't, like, a feat that actually helped you. It just made the game even more bloody and gory, and it was hilarious. And then, like, as the other games happened in the future, the more modern ones, it's, like, they didn't have that feat anymore, but they just continued on with the, you know, the extreme goriness. So they kind of had to have it.
So that's the only sort of caveat I would have for people. If you're otherwise, I would say like 100% watch this.
Yeah.
But that's the only thing. It's like if you're not that into, if you're like turned off by gore, this is a pretty like really gory show.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we get into like quibbles, because I do have kind of a lot, but I wanted to mention how much I love the music.
Oh yeah,
I think the music is really good, but also the this kind of reflection of the 50s, and it comes up a lot, and they're cribbing like a ton of stuff from like actual history, which is really cool. So just things like the communist like Red Scare, and it's really it's very funny, and it's like really true to life, where the Walton Goggins character, he's an actor. Oh, and by the way, he was a war hero, which was actually pretty common in the 50s for actors like Audie Murphy, you know, goes from like this celebrated war hero to like a celebrated actor. So like that was the vibe I was getting from him. But
he was described as fighting in that Anchorage battle. That is that DLC that you mentioned earlier from Fallout 3. And he like wore the power armor and that and everything. And so that was cool.
And in that conversation, he actually mentions that the power armor had defects, which is like more cribbing from history, where like the M14s or the M16s in Vietnam like had defects and caused a lot of soldiers to die. And it's like no one talked about the M16s. I mean, now it's like it's a known thing, but you know, these flaws in like the military industrial complex, where it's like, oh well, we can just make a bunch of weapons and we do it shitty and make a bunch of money. And you know, I think there's tones of that, and it's like those tones actually get little dialogue moments in this show that make sense with the canonical, like the in canon universe. So like the battle of Anchorage is talking about the failing power suits and that how they have like these like malfunctions that cause them to die. And that becomes a plot point later. But, and then he also mentions, they're like, oh yeah, and this is in like the, scene that takes place in before the bombs get dropped. There's the Red Scare, and, they're pulling out, writers from his show that were communist, and it changes the storylines of the shows that he's shooting, and they're making, you know, it's like making more propaganda. Mm-hmm. And and he comments on it. He's like, oh, he was a communist, but he was such a good writer. And we know like so many of the best writers got blacklisted mm-hmm. and had to write under pseudonyms in the 50s. So I think that kind of that cribbing from history is really cool to see. And then the way they weave it in with like the actual design of this milieu is just like perfect. Mm. It's just like a 10 out of 10.
Well, there's like a video I watched. It's the 111 Easter eggs you missed in, you know, so there's like every prop, like literally like every prop is something from one of the games, every newspaper, every gun, every
I should go watch that. Oh yeah. I mean, I noticed a lot of them, but I'd love to see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to say with the music, I thought the music was great. A bunch of the music is directly from the games. Yeah. Like that Maybe You'll Think of Me song. That is actually literally the first thing you hear when you load up Fallout 1. And then after the song, ends, it doesn't play the whole song, but once the song stops in the game, the next thing you hear is literally War Never Changes. And I was like, holy shit, I knew both of those things were iconic in my mind as Fallout things, but I didn't remember that they were literally the first things you hear. I mean, unless they added that in retrospect, because I mean, I just loaded up the game again. The other day.
That's how it's always been.
Yeah. Okay, good.
but I want to get Teresa back in here. So Teresa, any other, anything else you want to mention?
I'm sorry, kind of went a little all over the place a little bit. just what would you like me to comment on? I'm sorry.
Well, okay. So it sounds like there's some, concern about Maximus. You said that you liked him less than the other characters.
I did. I feel bad about that because I'd never seen this actor before. And I thought, he was good in some aspects for Maximus, like when he was having like this internal conflict about doing the right thing. And so often he kind of chose a selfish, self-serving thing. And you could see that the wheels behind his eyes clicking. But then I felt like a lot of the time the act, I don't want to get too personal, but it just felt like the actor was maybe a little flat. Compared to, and there were a few other actors in the Brotherhood storyline that I wasn't super falling in love with. Mm-hmm. It wasn't as easy for me as it was with Lucy and the Ghoul.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like though that, I mean, Lucy and Cooper were both raised in kind of normal circumstances and Maximus was raised in this sort of military, religious kind of Brotherhood thing. So it would make sense that he's sort of weird and,
absolutely. I mean, Lucy's weird too. Like, let's get into the cousins.
But that his lack of emotional affect, it seems like, would make sense for the character.
For me, I guess it was just feeling more invested in the Ghoul and, how his past related to his present. And then with Lucy and the mystery of the vaults and going after her father, which, when we're talking about like that 50s kind of optimism, that sheen of optimism and, the facade, really, I think having Kyle MacLachlan play Lucy's father was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. 'Cause when I see him, it's like, oh, it's good guy, wholesome Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks. It's, Charlotte's first husband on Sex in the City, who's just like waspy and a doofus. Like, how could you not like this guy with his like thumbs up and his big smile and good hair? He's a good guy.
The mayor in Portlandia.
Yeah, the mayor in Portlandia. Exactly. He's a good guy. And then to watch that progression and that mystery, holy shit, he did such a great job in that finale.
Yeah.
Like, that was amazing acting from Kyle MacLachlan. I haven't seen that side of him since. Geez, like I could hardly think maybe Blue Velvet, but not even. Yeah. He was great.
And just real quick, I mean, like, how amazing was that de-aging of him when they had him show up in Cooper's timeline? Like, that looks so good.
That looked really good. And for me, one of my favorite parts of that was, again, like how the writers, like, there were some elements that were so strong. It was like the fact that Harry mentioned to Cooper how much he loved that line that he played as the sheriff, which made Cooper hate himself for kind of saying it. And I'm like, oh, you guys like really thought of all this. So well done. Just well done.
Okay. Well, so Zach and John both said they had a long list of quibbles. So let's not get into the long list of quibbles, but why don't you pick like your top one or two? What are your top one or two quibbles?
I think that there's just a, they're small, but there's like a long laundry list of like missing plot points that they started. And then like, maybe we'll get to season two, or maybe it doesn't matter, or I don't know. But for instance, there's like a bit in the second half about the water chip not working in Vault 31 or Vault 33. And the deal is like, if the water chip is not working, they are all going to die in like 2 weeks if the water chip is not working. And then that's just mentioned. It's just mentioned.
See, I think that was just a joke because it's a reference to the first game.
Yeah, that's
game.
From Fallout 1. Yeah. That's your first quest.
I mean, but then it doesn't get resolved. It's like all of those people are going to die. I mean,
I guess they must have found a new water chip in Vault 32 or something once the Raiders attacked or
and
something.
And like Moldaver, like, why is she still alive? I guess, I mean, I can just get over that. Maybe she was in a, maybe she was cryogenically frozen. Whatever that.
Yeah, that was a big question for me too. Why didn't that get answered?
Yeah, and then there's a scene, and again, like Dave, I watched a lot of this deep into the night, and so I was like getting a little loopy. But there's a scene where the ghoul gets caught, and he gets brought to this guy who's like kind of like a boss. His name's Sorrel Booker. Oh, and then
he's like the president guy.
Yeah. He's like, I'm the president, and feed him to the hogs. My two deputies, and then he just kills these guys and then ends the scene basically. And then the next time you see the ghoul, he's like in a totally different setting and he's like looking for Moldaver. So it just felt like, what did I, was there an episode in between or this scene was not like concluded properly, at least for me. It's, he killed those guys and then he was like maybe going to kill the president, but then, or maybe they were going to sit down and have a conversation, but then that is not shown. So you kind of can just think about maybe what happened. And I kind
of, that's interesting. Yeah. I do feel like toward like around episode 7, there was maybe like they were cutting stuff out for time or something.
That's exactly what I guess to sum all of my criticism would be that, and I never ever fucking say this, but this series could have used like one more short episode between 6 and 7 and 8, somewhere in there, because there were those the little things that I felt like needed a little bit more meat on the bone. Like speaking of meat, dog meat, like he seemed like there was a building towards some kind of meaningful a situation or payoff, and then that goes nowhere. He's just a dog in the show, so don't get your hopes up about whatever's going on with dog meat, unless that's going to be in the next season. So,
I wish there was more dog meat.
Well, like my thing was, I felt like the scene where Moldaver in the past convinces Cooper to spy on his wife, I felt like he would have needed a lot more convincing. Like it seems like he just agreed to do that kind of really quick and kind of randomly.
And I was like, why would he, like, once he said no, why would he even take the device? Like, why would you keep that with you? She's like, oh, you know, keep it. Like, I just said no. Why would I keep
it? Well, and there's obviously, like, there's something else there because that's the end. He spies on her. And then we're at a birthday party where he needs money. So, like, that, which is how episode one starts, which is, like, future in the time. So, it's like, there's still some missing links that I feel like would have gone well in an episode, an inserted episode 7 or 8. Like, what we need a little bit more. Why is he down on his luck enough to where he has to fill in at a birthday party?
I mean, some of this stuff I can accept is going to be filled in season 2. Yeah, like, how he become a ghoul.
What,
you know,
I'm
we don't
thinking
know.
Yeah. When he's going to look for his family and
he's probably going to have the pre-war stuff throughout his whole story, I would imagine. They're not going to wrap that completely. There's going to be a lot more of that.
Cool. I hope not, because that was like really fun and exciting stuff.
And I'm with you. I kind of hope not too, because it did, when I was watching it, it reminded me a little of the Man in Black in Westworld, right? Mm-hmm. Where you're watching these two timelines, these characters, the past, mm-hmm. and I'm like, what makes a character like the ghoul or the Man in Black mm-hmm. really interesting is that you don't know a super ton about him. Like, I feel like I kind of know enough, but, you know, if you explore it too much and put too much light on all of that, it kind of takes away some of the mystique.
Yeah,
I think. But I do mm-hmm. think, you know, there'll be more for that in season two. And, you know, I want to go back and watch the first episode again, because, yeah, I was wondering, like, so did he start speaking out against Vol-Tec? I mean, I feel like that ease that he wanted to spy on his wife didn't seem to quite come out of nowhere. He struck me as someone who was always really wary of Vol-Tec and making money off the apocalypse. Like, he didn't seem like a straight up soulless corporate shill. You know, I think
I just thought there should have been some dialogue about, you know, your wife's not who you think she is. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yes, she is. And he's like, well, if you're so certain, why don't you just listen in? Like, what do you have to be afraid? Like mm-hmm. something like where he just, it seems like he needed more persuasion than just that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She basically says like, I invented cold fusion, now spy on your wife. And he's kind of like, you know,
yeah.
I thought there just should have been more of a scene. There needs to be more of a scene mm-hmm. there. Yeah. But so John, what's your top quibble?
Yeah. Yeah, so like I'm not gonna quibble on editorial matters as you might expect me to, but I mean, one of my big quibbles is that the gulper is like the big monster that we get in the show, and it's because it's like I didn't even know what that was. I had to like look it up, and when I looked it up, it's like, oh, it's from what's it called, Far Harbor DLC from Fallout 4, which apparently I did not get to, and Fallout 76, and I'm like, what the hell? Like, we're going to get like one big monster in the first season, and it's the gulper. Like, how about a Deathclaw? Where's all my super mutants at? Like, they went into so many locations where I was like, oh, these were going to be the super mutants. And then they weren't. So I was kind of disappointed with that kind of stuff. I feel like they didn't throw enough stim packs around. Like, stim packs are everywhere in fucking Fallout, man. Like, you know, you gotta, you see a stim pack, you better take it. And also just like, so we did get like one shot of somebody taking a puff of a jet, in the beginning. So I was like, okay, good. But then it's like, you know, nobody takes Mentats. Like, you know, nobody takes any of the other drugs except for Radaway, which I liked that they did that. I don't remember how the power armor, like, animation is in the game per se, as far as like the fusion core goes, but I'm like, when Maximus's squire like is like outside the armor and he's able to just take the core out, it's like, come on, like, talk about design flaws. That's fucking stupid as hell. Like, why would somebody else be able to take the fusion core out? Come on, guys, like, you gotta protect that shit. So those are the sort of big quibbles that come to mind. I mean, if I was like rewatching it and like, you know, doing a commentary along, like, I'm sure I would have other things to say. But you know, like I said, I mean, I was very happy with the show. So, I mean, there's just like, there's like little things from being a hardcore Fallout nerd that like sort of jump out at me as like missed opportunities or like, you know, kind of seems like that's off or something.
So you wanted more drugs, but, basically.
Kidding. Well, yeah, definitely. I definitely wanted more drugs. I mean, I don't know. There's something about the drugs in Fallout that are just so cool. I love that Jet, like, is in an inhaler, you know? You know, I don't know. They're just so omnipresent in the games that it seems like they were really lacking not being in there more.
So the part where Thaddeus, the squire, he drinks this like yellow liquid that turns him into a ghoul, and then he can instantly regenerate. Mm-hmm. Is that how it works in the game, or was that taking some liberty?
Yeah, I don't remember. I don't actually remember that at all. I mean, I don't remember anybody actually turning into a ghoul. Maybe they did. There is a lot of ghoul stuff in like Fallout 3, I think, where like, you know, you kind of are talking to not feral ones and stuff, maybe for the first time. I don't remember if they were like that in previous games, but I don't remember anybody ever actually turning into one by drinking.
It just seemed the way they set it up, I feel like more people would be doing it. It seems like the
the upsides are kind of good, you know, if you're like immortal and can regenerate everything, you know.
Yeah.
Well, except for your
nose. You have to look like a ghoul.
Seems like a small price to pay for living for 100 years, especially since, you know, Cooper's still pretty hot, even with no nose. So.
Honestly,
no lies detected. It's still Walton Goggins under there.
Yeah. I can't remember if I said this in the Baldur's Gate 3 panel, but like I was thinking that between the Githyanki in Baldur's Gate 3 and then the ghoul in Fallout, like people are going to be doing all kind of crazy plastic surgery to their nose in the coming future, you know, because they're like, hey, that ghoul is hot. Hey, that Githyanki's hot. Like, let me do some modifications to my face to look more like that. So that might be interesting.
See, how about Teresa? Do you have any quibbles that you wanted to mention?
Well, I mean, aside from Aaron Moten's affect or lack of in some of the episodes. Yeah, I mean, just not being as intimately familiar with all of the Fallout universe world. For me, I guess, you know, I feel like I still need to think a little bit about what was going on in 31, 32, and 33. I still feel like a little bit confused about what was going on between all three of those. Like, I kind of get it, but then I feel, but wait, what happened to 31? That was just, there was no 31, really. But so some of that stuff got a little confusing for me.
Yeah.
Well, so 31, there was just a bunch of cryo tanks, and it was all the, like, Vault Tech. It was like Buds. It was like his training program.
I hated that guy so much. I love to hate that guy.
Yeah, that guy was the worst. Was
I didn't actually get on my... I just rewatched that episode. And so the brain in the on the Roomba thing is actually Bud's brain. I don't think I got that the first...
So I don't understand that part at all. If he was the head of this, like, you know, program, why the fuck would he volunteer to have his brain put in that robot? And it's like he seems very unhappy. Like, you know, it's like he was like, oh, I wish I could sleep or something. I don't know. He says something to that effect. It's like, why wouldn't he be one of the people in the fucking tanks?
I mean, it might be that because it's his thing, he has to be awake to supervise the whole time.
That was the only way.
You gotta delegate
managers delegate.
Yeah, he's all about management, right? Like, the future of the world is management. So, like, come on, bro, you gotta delegate.
But yeah, so basically, I mean, that's basically it, right? Like, he had his like management people, and then like they would like come into the other vaults and pretend that they were from a real vault, but they were actually all people frozen from the past to be in charge of everything.
Yeah. So one comment I have is about Vault Tech. You know, so in the games, Vault Tech is, depending on like how much you drill into it, they're evil, just like, oh, they were just evil, or like, you know, at best they're really inept and or like have very questionable morality to the way they operated. But, you know, generally, like, you know, they're evil. But like, and then in the show, it's like, oh shit, they're going to make it so that Vault Tech actually started the war. I don't think that was ever explicitly noted in the games. It's like, I mean, it makes sense that, you know, the way the narrative goes that they would want, you know, it's good for business for the apocalypse to happen, because it's like they built all these vaults and stuff. But I suspect that that change was largely to do with like they didn't want to have to actually blame any particular countries for the apocalypse. Maybe it was actually a crassly commercial decision, just because they want to be able to like sell the show to China. And they was like, because in the games, like, China basically starts the war.
Well,
depends on who you ask, I guess.
But I also feel like from a narrative standpoint, Cooper has to find out some horrifying truth about his wife at the climax.
Yeah.
So, you know, there has to be some way that she's, you know, not just kind of going along with it, but she has to say something shocking, you know, that shocks the audience with how bad it is.
And it sure did.
I do love that she drops the war never changes line. It felt like it came about at the right point in the show. I actually kind of thought like it might be literally the last line in the first season, just because like we hadn't seen it before that point. But then she says it, and I thought it was perfect. And then like, so I guess one other quibble is like when like Cooper then says it again later, and I'm like, okay, I mean, we already heard it. It was great when she said it. When he's saying it, it's like kind of like a rerun. Like, I didn't really feel like that didn't really work for me. I will also say too, like, you know, like I love dog meat in the games, in all the iterations of him. And it's like when the dog shows up, it's like, of course it's dog meat, right? Mm-hmm. But it's like the way they drop his name is just kind of fell flat for me. It's like, okay. You know, it's just like the ghoul says it one time and it's like, I don't know. It's like, where did that even come from? You know, he just decided the dog's name was dog meat. Sure. Okay. But, yeah, I don't know. It just kind of fell flat for me.
Well, I guess another thing, I didn't rewatch this episode, so maybe I'm not remembering it right. But when they first dig up Cooper, doesn't the guy say, like, if he doesn't do what we want, shoot him? And it's like, well, but shooting him has no effect. And they must know that, right? So that seems to not make any sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if you shoot him enough, it would have some effect.
It just seems like they probably had to know that they were, this is, you know, if he chose to fight them, this was not going to go well for them.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so in the games, like, I mean, you can definitely kill ghouls. They're not like totally immortal or invincible. And I'm not clear to what point in the show, like, you would have to damage one of them to actually kill them for good. I mean, I guess the ghoul, like Cooper, does kill one of the ghouls at some point. So clearly they can be killed, if enough damage is done to them. I mean, and then, I mean, maybe only if you eat their asses. I mean, cause he made some ass jerky.
All right. The thing that I wasn't clear about when we're talking ghouls, Lucy's mom.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Why was Moldaver keeping her alive as a ghoul for so long? I mean, I understand that maybe there was some love between them as a friend, but I'm with Lucy. I don't want to see anybody like that.
Yeah.
Especially if I love them.
I also questioned that. And like, I kind of thought like maybe there was some suggestion that Moldaver and Lucy's mom are actually like had a romantic thing. And so that's why she didn't want to let her go. But like, regardless of what the level of love was, if you love that person and like you care about them, why in the fuck would you keep them in this state of half life as a ghoul?
It's the cool factor. It's a
cool. It's not that, 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 wasn't, it, that, was, that was fucked up. That was fucked up
and it was dumb because like as soon as Lucy entered that room there, first off, I mean, all right. So maybe that was some of my quibble with like, okay, this show is really great. And I wouldn't say anything was fumbled in the end, but it was a little like, okay, so Kyle MacLachlan's just been sitting in a bird cage for how long? And Moldaver's not going to find other ways to torture him. It seems like there's lots of great tech for torturing information out of people. But then, like, as soon as you saw the ghoul tied to the chair, I'm like, oh, that's Lucy's mom. They never found the body, right? So, I'm like, her. So, like, how did...
Well, I think the way I would read it is that it was all Moldaver's plan to have Lucy come. Like, she knew that the only way she could get the information was if Lucy wanted her dad to give it up. So, that was kind of her plan for getting the information. Mm-hmm. And maybe she wanted to give Lucy a chance to say goodbye to her mom. And so, that's why she was kind of keeping her around.
But, I mean, she had, I mean, how long was this plan in the planning stages? Exactly. Like, she had to keep that woman as a ghoul for a long fucking time.
And honestly, it could have been any ghoul she has the same necklace as my mom. Oh, obviously it's my mom.
It's just some random ghoul and she put the necklace on her. That would be hilarious.
I mean, she was kind of duplicitous. You never know, but.
Dave, I have John, I have a question for you. Like,
yes.
Because you're a fan of the series, were you kind of like taken aback or like, oh yeah, when you found out that Moldaver was like in charge of the new California Republic?
Oh,
like, I was like, I was like, oh, that's cool. It was like, it was like 1:30 in the morning. I was like, oh yeah.
No, I thought that was cool. Yeah, for sure. It felt like, I think Fallout New Vegas is where the new California Republic was sort of most present in the game. Because I love that game the most, that was really cool to see it like so heavily, like in the end game part of the show. It was totally cool to have her end up being in charge. Although it did make me kind of wonder, like, what was that dude supposed to be president of?
Yeah. That guy's not. He's not a guy with.
I mean, he was sitting in this like little fucking hovel, like with a bunch of dumbass deputies.
Yeah,
like,
he's like, I'm a heavy. You know, like no,
no. Yeah,
no. But I thought that was the point, is that maybe he's just like basically sheriff of this town or something, but he's declaring himself.
He's just some guy. Yeah. You know.
Self-appointed.
Yeah, I mean, anybody could do that in the Fallout world. But so also, so Shady Sands is all destroyed and everything. And like, I remembered the name Shady Sands, but I didn't actually remember this either, that, that's the first place you get in Fallout 1 too. Like, it's not blown up at that point. It's like just a community. And then at some point it gets blown up, and I don't know how that actually happens, if it happens in game or it happens between games. I don't know. Maybe it's not until New Vegas that you encounter it again, or because it's in California, I think, or in that vicinity. And Fallout 1 was set like sort of in the Nevada, California area, which Wasteland, that original game back then, that was also set in Nevada. So I think that was the reason for that. But yeah, just funny. It's funny to see all these things that I just totally didn't remember. And it's like, oh, shit, that is like way back from Fallout 1.
I thought the ending was really epic. Like, it's like you.
Yeah.
I think maybe for people who are less familiar with the games, but it's like the new California Republic, like, kind of did have its shit together for a little bit. It seemed like lore wise, and then now we're seeing like a different side of that, and that these are like two big power struggles now. Just going to war with each other, and it was like epic, but also kind of sad, because it's like, oh, there is organized, like, it's not complete chaos, and then immediately like these two superpowers just like obliterating each other, and it's like, oh, that's cool, but also really sad.
Well, so apparently, like, so Kyle MacLachlan at the last shot, he's looking out at New Vegas, right? So does that make you excited to see New Vegas in season 2 based on having played the game?
Oh, yeah.
But also sad, because New Vegas was not hit by a nuke in New Vegas. Like, it was actually a city. Like, it was protected. Yeah. And there are, like, buildings. But then what Kyle MacLachlan is looking at is, like, a destroyed New Vegas. So it looks like it's been destroyed since the events of... I could be wrong, but it looks like it's been destroyed.
I think there were destroyed parts of it. I can't really remember, but I mean, I don't remember what he actually saw in the final moments. I mean, I remember the sign, and that's like right when you see that, like, pretty far out, before you even really get to the city proper.
For me, I was in Las Vegas like a month ago. So then immediately I'm like, oh no, that's the Stratosphere. Oh, I think that's the Bellagio. Oh boy. So definitely able to pick out some of the casinos from afar. So I'm excited.
Oh, but speaking of the new California Republic though, like, and this is in the games, but I just love seeing the flag with the two-headed bear. Like, that's just so perfect. It's so like, yes, exactly. That's what the flag should be.
I just wanted to like wake everyone up in my house and be like, oh, look at this. And they'd be like, what are you talking about?
So I don't have one of those. I feel like I should have that prop in my house, because I didn't actually realize the extent of how much Fallout paraphernalia I have. Yeah. But like, so we have, I have a Vault-Tec decal on the back window of my car. and I have a Fallout baseball cap or a Vault-Tec baseball cap. It has the logo on it. And I have a keychain that is my main keychain that I use every day. And it's a Nuka-Cola remover. Yeah. So, and it's like, I've had these things for like so long. It's just like, I forget that I have them. I probably have something else around here too, but.
Pip-Boy keychain actually this week, where I was like, nice. Oh my gosh, like it must've been from some long ago Comic-Con promotion, where I'm like, maybe it's time to make a little purse storm out of this.
I have a question. Yeah. What is everyone looking forward to in season 2? Cause it did get greenlit.
Mm-hmm, right.
I want to see the Deathclaw. For sure.
Oh, absolutely.
For me, I just want to see the ghoul, Lucy, and Dogmeat like being sarcastic and funny with each other, and watching more of Lucy's disillusionment grow as she sees, like, as she wakes up to the state of the world and the power struggles.
Yeah.
You know what I want to see is more power armor. You never get enough power armor.
I was not knocking the power armor. itself. That was cool. And I always love practical effects. Everything here looked really, really smooth. They spent, you could tell they spent so much money and practical effects, like, you know, Mad Max Fury Road. It's practical always looks better.
Yeah.
Always.
I love the power armor, but I do feel like we got a decent amount of it. I mean, especially considering like the Fallout series. Like, there's so many other things. Like, in Fallout, you probably see as many super mutants as you see Brotherhood of Steel, like, walking tank power.
Oh, you see more.
So, like, I want to see super mutants. And I think we think there was a super mutant in this show in episode 2. Like, there was something massive on a gurney being
you see like an arm or something.
Yeah, and its hand is really huge. It kind of looks like a Hulk weird looking hand. And I think maybe that might have been a super mutant, or like hinting at a superhuman or a super mutant.
Yeah.
I want to see Zetas too, because there's fucking aliens in Fallout. Yeah, yeah. You know, I want to see
I doubt they're going to go into all that.
Yeah, maybe season 3. Maybe season 4.
I forgot earlier, I was going to say, one of the things that I had thoughts about, like, when I first, like, I watched the first episode, and I was, like, excited about certain things, and, like, or maybe it was, like, the first and second one, I can't remember when it came up, but when they laid out the initial plot points, like, I was, like, okay, so that's dog meat, and then I was, like, oh, maybe they're talking about the Garden of Eden creation kit, the Gek, which is from Fallout 3. And it's like, I just fucking love that thing ever since playing that game. It's like, oh man, that's such a cool idea.
So the idea,
because it's like the big MacGuffin. Yeah,
it's like it restores, it like removes radiation and like it for like, I don't know, like a square mile or something. So like you could use it to like repopulate the surface and make like an area livable and like farmable. And I want to see more of that. Those things are awesome. Like, I think that's in other Fallout too. I mean, I could be wrong, but I think.
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah. But, you know, it's like, so Cold Fusion is cool, of course. But I mean, it's like, oh, well, okay. I mean, that could have been in any show. You know, something like the Garden of Eden creation kit, that's like a Fallout thing. And like, so I was like a little disappointed that it's like the big secret that, you know, was so vital and being smuggled and being hunted after was.
But I think that.
Because I mean, Cold Fusion is like too big of a thing almost to have.
Yeah, I think the reason they didn't go with the Gekt is because.
Yeah.
Every vault is supposed to have one, so they may be super common, even though like America still looks like a wasteland. There's at least 100 of them, right? Because there's like 100 plus vaults, so maybe that's why they were lore wise they didn't want to go with that. That's my guess.
Yeah. I do feel like we kind of saw too many vaults in season one, given like how sparse they seemed to be, like when you play the game, and given how low level like Lucy really still was by the end of the first season. Like I saw somebody, I think they statted her out even, and like she was like remarkably low level. You know, it's like given that level of advancement, we saw way too many vaults already.
Yeah, this is like our Baldur's Gate 3 conversation all
over again. Well, I'm here for that.
Another thing I'm looking forward to in season 2 is more cameos. There were some really great one-off guest stars throughout this series. Matt Berry. Can we take a moment to appreciate Matt Berry and how he elevates
he's so good.
Every goddamn thing he's in with that voice? Unreal.
Yeah. 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 He was perfect as that crazy robot, the crazy medical robot.
And Chris Parnell was great. Cyclops.
Actually,
Yeah,
you know, actually, I found his eye really upsetting. I guess you're supposed to, but like, I don't know. I didn't really love his character that much.
I like when
I generally like that
they
guy.
Turned it around and he's just a good guy.
Exactly. Like your punishment is we are banishing you.
Like, oh my god.
Oh, so another quibble. So okay, so when she goes to that vault, they're all like, "Oh, don't go to level 12." And it's like he's like stupid. So it's like, you know, it's kind of a joke that he's like telling her exactly where she needs to go. But like when she gets in the elevator, she just like pushes a button and she gets to go there. And I'm like, "Well, she doesn't even have to do anything to get to vault 12 or level 12. They didn't block it." And it's like in the game, you would have had to do that weird hacking thing that you can do where like you have to kind of like guess the puzzle phrase or whatever the fuck that is. It took me so long to figure that out.
But we actually literally see her brother doing that for half the season.
I know. I was going to say, since they actually even did put it in the show, why didn't she have to do that to get into the elevator?
You don't want to do it the same thing twice, though.
She receives no special points for that.
No. Well, I mean, for my money, I would have rather seen her do it in the elevator than have him, you know, do it on the computer. But I guess it was.
But like, no, but it sort of made sense because they're so like good natured and trusting and like everything. It made sense. That
Cameos.
Yeah. Fred Armisen.
Yes.
I think in the last episode. Yeah. Or he's great.
Yeah. Oh, that was hilarious, by the way, that it's like, you know, Maximus gives Lucy the head that they've all been after. And then he just picks up another head that was on the ground to give to the Brotherhood. And it was like, and that was kind of perfect because of how they set it up with all the traps that the guy has.
I don't remember this lore wise, but I love how the squires are like caddies. They're just walking around like they're, you know, dragging around golf clubs. For a golfer, it's so funny to me.
Well, apparently that's a joke in the game because you'll like get a helper character and then you just like give him all your all the inventory to that character so you don't have to carry it. So it's kind of like a winking reference to that.
Hmm. Oh right, yeah. Like
I don't even remember
like Lydia
that.
in Skyrim.
Sworn to carry your burdens. The other decal I have on my car is a College of Winterhold decal.
Nice.
That's awesome. All right, so now we know how to spot John on the road.
Yeah.
All right, so we should start wrapping this up pretty soon. So why don't we get into some final thoughts? So, Zach, final thoughts on Fallout Season 1.
I know I was I had my small quibbles, but like I think pretty much all of that stuff I can just completely look past or will be fixed in a season two.
A future patch.
Yeah, in a future patch, in an update, like when they release the episode that was supposed to happen between season 7. this is as perfect of an adaptation of a video game as what I'm looking for. It's like, like Dave said, a miracle that it's this good. It's as expansive as a setting like Star Wars. Like it really feels like there's these factions, there's these speculative elements, there's like your little almost Star Trek-y like mini-sodes where you go into a vault and you find out, you know, either tragic things that happened or, you know, a weird experiment thing that happened and you can kind of like just gnaw on the science fiction elements and the weirdness of something momentarily before going back into this extremely expansive setting and now plot and an epic plot. Really like, you know, 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 for me, like, please make more of this. And sorry that your marketing is bad. I really hope, you know, you'll do more capitalistic shit to market this better or something.
How about Teresa? Final thoughts?
Yeah, I thought this was a real win. You know, as someone who's somewhat familiar with the Fallout games, not as much as my fellow panelists, I thought this really stands on its own and introduce this great world with this retrofuturism, post-apocalypse, and then the characters. Like, some of these characters are really memorable. Like, the ghoul is an icon. I cannot wait to watch more of him and Lucy and all the other characters in the next season. I thought it was just the perfect balance between, like, humor, horror, science fiction, and family drama.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, and again, the concept of Fallout, this juxtaposing of the cheery tech 50s techno optimism mm-hmm. with the post-apocalyptic nuclear war stuff is just a brilliant idea. You know, whoever had that idea in the first place,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just
Brian Fargo.
Well, I don't know. I mean, because Tim Kaine was, I don't know. I don't know exactly who.
Yeah. Who's brainchild?
Because, you know,
yeah.
I mean, any video game, there's lots of different people working on.
Sure,
stuff,
sure, but, sure.
You know, I mean, but that aesthetic is just such a inspired thing. And so just to have a whole TV show built around mm-hmm. that. And it just works. Yeah. Just the jumping back and forth between the, you know, the past and the future and everything, just everything is, and it's like the satirical stuff, like everything about it, you know, the corporate satire is just so spot on. It's just,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it's just like a show that it just should not work. Just on paper, you're like, this should not be this good, but it's just somehow it's just, you know, sometimes there's just this alchemy where just magic happens, just kind of, you mm-hmm. know, where things just turn out so much better than they have any right to be. And it just seems like that's what happened here. So yeah, definitely hoping the same thing happens in season two. But so John, final thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I loved it. You know, and I just echo what y'all have been saying. I mean, it's like it's basically a perfect adaptation of a beloved video game series. And so, hey, listen, people, like, if you love Fallout and you love to see what people who love Fallout have created, you know, I have a couple of books, you know, that, I mean, there's Wastelands 2, there's Wastelands 3, there's The End Is Nigh. The End Has Come, The End Is Now, The End Has Come, you know, Loosed Upon the World is kind of post-apocalyptic. I got The Living Dead, The Living Dead 2. For Power Armor, there's a book called Armor that I did, and that's pretty cool. I'm just saying, man, I got a lot of material that y'all can delve into if you love Fallout and you just like need more shit in this vein. I have not gotten to edit a Fallout anthology yet. So if anybody who controls the rights of that is listening, I'm down. Otherwise, yeah, no, I mean, I just, you know, I just love the show. I'm, you know, I probably will rewatch it. I definitely will rewatch it before season two comes out, but,
I hope Todd Howard was listening because you have not said a bad thing about Todd Howard and you just said the invitation is open. So
yeah. Yeah. Todd Howard, yeah. Call me.
It's also funny, again, just, you know, how important Fallout has been in the lives of so many people on mm-hmm. this panel. And, you know, who would have ever known when you're making a, you know, an computer RPG yeah. back in the 90s that, you know, it would have mm-hmm. become such a popular thing and influence so many lives. So that's also yeah. cool. You just never know when you put some, yeah. you know, creative work out into the world, you know, what impact right. it's going to have decades down the line.
I just want to add one thing. When I was doing one of my essay anthologies, I actually managed to reach out to Brian Fargo and like I emailed with him and like that was super cool to me because I was like, oh my God, it's Brian Fargo. It's like you've mapped the inside of my brain, you know? And so he wasn't able to write an essay for it or maybe it was, it may have been like asking him to write a story for Wastelands 3 or something like that. I can't remember what it was. But it was just super cool to be able to talk to him.
Yeah.
So, and he was very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, Brian Fargo, if you're listening, we love you. That's all I was going to say.
Yes. And we should give Brian Fargo some other additional props because I mentioned the original game Wasteland. He did eventually get the rights to that, and so he made a Wasteland 2 and I think a Wasteland 3
Wasteland
as well.
Wasteland 3 is really good. It's on Xbox Game Pass, and it's very yeah. easy to recommend that.
It's just a coincidence that my anthologies are also Wastelands and Wastelands 2 and Wastelands 3. And his games were Wasteland and Wasteland 2 and Wasteland 3. You know, I borrowed that name before I realized that game was going to be like brought back to life and have sequels and stuff. It was like, you know, it was in the dustbin of history. So, it seemed safe at the time, but, he didn't seem to mind. Yeah. I did tell him about
it. So Brian Fargo, call us, but don't have your lawyer call us. All right, so on that note, why don't we wrap things up there? So we've been speaking with John Joseph Adams, Teresa DeLucci, and Zach Chapman. So thanks, everyone, so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Okie dokie.
And that was our panel. So big thanks again to John Joseph Adams, Teresa DeLucci, and Zach Chapman for joining us on the show.
Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. So if you enjoy the show and want it to continue, please support us on Patreon over at patreon.com/geeks or via PayPal over at geeksguideshow.com/crowdfunding. All right, so that was our show. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.